One of the stories that I love about in the Gospels is a story that we're going to look at today. And in one sense, I'm thinking, what a great time to for this particular story. The man we're going to look at is a man who was so low in life that everybody was hoping he would hit bottom, and he never did. And the worst about a fellow or a lady not hitting bottom is when they don't know they need to hit bottom. And that's the story of the fellow we're going to look at today. Now, why is this important for today? Over the last several months, almost every day, there's been new news about sexual harassment in our country, something that has been long overdue, something that's been in the shadows for a long, long time, and has finally come out to be exposed for the horror and shame of it. And some of the most well-known people in our country, some of the most successful professionally, have been exposed and suddenly find themselves with their reputation scorched, their name trashed. For some of these men, I wonder how they'll ever look their children in the eyes, or their wife, or their friends. For some of these people, you wonder what kind of career they'll ever have, or if they have to do something very different. As I think about these stories, I usually think about two things. I think about that there's two kinds of darkness. There's an outer darkness, of which we're familiar with in the news and which we hear the stories of, that needs to be changed, light brought to the outer darkness. But there's also an inner darkness in the heart of man that drives people to do things that down deep they know they shouldn't do, but still do anyway. An outer darkness is not just related to sexual harassment, but to almost all kinds of outer darkness. I mean, why do people take opiates? What is it about them that grabs hold of them and continues, even though they know that this is destructive to themselves and to the people that they love? Even simple things like overeating or smoking. Even simple things like this. Why do we keep doing? What is it inside of us that drives us to do these things? But there's not just outer darkness, but there's inner darkness maybe that nobody else knows about. Why am I so afraid? Why do I deal with fear so often? Why is every day I have to deal with anxiety or anger? What is it inside of me that drives me in these directions? And our story today, interestingly, deals with both outer and inner darkness. When I think about the gospel, I think about the wonder of what God's solution is to fix and address our human internal darkness that is to have an effect in our outer world. In John 11, Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies." Now, the context here is the resurrection of Lazarus from the dead. But the principle that he gives here is broader than just physical life. The ability to give life to our hearts inside of us to change from darkness to light or from death to life. 1 Peter, "What a God we have and how fortunate we are to have him, this Father of our Master Jesus, because Jesus was raised from the dead. We've been given a brand new life and have everything to live for." Again, he's talking about something that happens inside of the human heart that can only happen through Jesus Christ being alive inside a human being. A change at the very center of who we are. And then Isaiah 61, which Jesus quoted at the very beginning of his ministry. "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me. The Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom to the captives and release for the prisoners." Now, these verses here, he's using metaphors. He's not saying, Isaiah was not saying to preach good news to the poor, meaning if you're pretty well off financially, well, that's just too tough for you. He's using the metaphor of poor, meaning personally poor. There's something, there's a poverty of spirit inside of us that we need from him. To bind up the brokenhearted, this is not just people who have lost a loved one, but who realize there's something broken inside of me that I can't fix. And then, thirdly, to proclaim freedom to the captives and release for the prisoners. He's not talking about people who are in L.A. County Jail. He's talking about you and me who are captive, have been taken captive by sin, and in some ways have become prisoners of Satan without hardly even knowing it's happening. A new life. And our particular story today deals with both kinds of bondage, both outer bondage and inner. Our story begins in Mark 5, verse 1. It's the story I think of as the man of the tombs. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. The disciples had been with Jesus all day in ministry. They got on a boat. They were crossing the Sea of Galilee. We looked at the great storm that they went through that night and almost lost their lives, it seemed. The boat almost being swamped, and Jesus spoke to the wind and the rain, and the storm stopped. And the story sort of picks up here. I think somewhere at early dusk when the boat comes ashore on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee in a an area with hardly any people in it, maybe a few dotted towns around there, but they land in an area that's fairly forsaken. But when Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This is quite a person. This is somebody that hasn't hit bottom yet. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. Now we have several vivid pictures of this man. There are several things that strike me as he's introduced here in verse 5. In the hills, night and day, he would cry out. And I wonder, what would he cry out? As you get to know who this man is, there are two things I think of which he cries out. One is rage, a rage against God and a rage against life and the realities of life and the hardship of life and how people have done him wrong. And the second aspect of crying out, I think, is something of what we would say is lament. The lament of a wasted life. Where did it all go wrong? How did this train get off the rails? To such a point, Mark records at the end of verse 5 that he cut himself with stones. Took stones in the ground and made marks on his arm and across his torso and on his legs. And when I think about What would possess a man to do something like that or a woman to do something like that? One of the things that strikes me is that there is such a longing in the human heart to want to make an impact with another human being. What do you do when you can't make an impact with anyone? Or it seems like the impact you make is not good at all. And yet there's still that drive in the human heart to know that you did something that was impactful. And here, even cutting yourself makes sense to someone. We see this in our world even today, especially among teenagers. Verse 6, when he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God you won't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." And here is this convoluted mixture of two things happening simultaneously, almost like the person is split in half. In one sense, you have a picture of him worshiping by kneeling down at the feet of Jesus and calling him the Son of the Most High, which is correct. But at the other time, his image here is, "Swear to God that you won't torture me." And this is about as blasphemous a statement as can be made about Jesus Christ. This strange, odd mix in this man. Verse 9. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied. And then notice the pronoun. "For we are many." And there's just one standing there. "We are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. Now, in our particular world, counselors deal with people with all kinds of problems and issues. And I wonder what a modern-day counselor would do with the man of the tombs if the man of the tombs walked into his office or her office. What in the world would you say would be the clinical definition of this person, and what kind of treatment would you offer? And what chance of it being effective would there be? One of the things that strikes me, secondly, about this is that if I had been one of the disciples, as this guy's running down the hills toward me, naked, with chains on, I think I would have been backing up towards that boat. And yet Jesus is unfazed by this man. I sort of have the sense that he's sort of walking towards him, ready to engage who he is, in spite of the mess of his life and who he is. Verse 11, a large herd of pigs was feeding on a nearby hillside. And the imagery is something like, here they are at the shoreline, and the man has run out of the hills and the tombs from up on the hill down to the shoreline. And Mark says down the shore up to the north, instead of the shoreline, there are cliffs there. And up on this bluff, there are a large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons beg Jesus through the voice of the man, send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them. He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out of the man and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank, plunged down into the lake, and were drowned. Now, the picture here is one of outer bondage that Jesus is dealing with. But the story also has to do with inner bondage. And it's the inner bondage not just of the man, but of the normal people. People like your neighbors. Or maybe people like you think of yourself. And we pick up this sort of these two inner bondage stories in the normal people and the man of the tombs simultaneously. Verse 14. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside. So however many were up there with the pigs, we aren't told how many, they go running off to the town, they spread the news to the town, and it is so astounding that they continue to other little outlets and hamlets passing on this word. Apparently they all came out to see what happened. Verse 15, when they came to Jesus, they saw the man of the tombs, who had been possessed by the legion of demons, sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Now, one of the things I love about these stories is the reality and some of the details that we're given that might be easy for us to overlook. For example, they came and they noticed Mark says he was sitting there. Why would you include something like that? When the people came out, that would have been a marvel to them because they had chained this man around his ankles and his wrists because he was untamable. This is a man on the loose. ADD on steroids. And here he is sitting. And then I love the next thing that he says, Mark records. Sitting there, dressed. I guess that's important to add, if you're particularly in this particular case, because this man apparently didn't like clothes, and suddenly he's clothed. Now, you think about writing that, sitting there, dressed. You can imagine, I think about, what if I wrote down some notes about my day today? After worship, I had Horizon, and then Mindy and I decided to go to dinner tonight, and we went over to Chili's. And when I went into Chili's, I noticed that everybody was dressed. And so we decided to stay. That's sort of what you think, dressed, because it is so shocking that this man would be. And then he says, in his right mind, something had changed in the man, something internal, not just external. But then you have this great picture of inner bondage in the normal people by the next observation Mark makes. And they were afraid. Why would they be afraid? Why would the next phrase not read, they were amazed and joyful? Because they thought about this man's life and the old life that he had and the train wreck he had made of this. or the train wreck he'd made of his personal life, or his professional life, or his marriage, or his kids, or all of his friends, or the people that he grew up with. Why would they not be joyful? Why would they be afraid? Verse 16. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Now we have a clue as to why these folks were afraid. Verse 17. Then the people began to plead with Jesus. Please stay. Such power we've never seen in a human being. And maybe you can do something to help all of us. But that's not what Mark records. In fact, the response of the people is completely opposite of that. They began to plead with Jesus to leave. Please, not just their town, not just the beach, their region is what Mark records. Please leave their region. I think, why would that be their response? And in a nutshell, I think because it's a statement about their values, what they really value. They were afraid, verse 15, pleaded him to leave. There are a few notes in your handout. We experience fear when whatever we think will bring us happiness is threatened. What's exposed here is what their real value or their method of what's going to bring happiness is exposed right here. And that prompts fear when they think it's threatened. They saw all these pigs, several thousand pigs, take off across and jump off the bluff and landing splat down in the Sea of Galilee. And I wonder if the townsfolks thought that maybe their business was next. And they just couldn't face something like that. And then the second thing, I cannot control the factors I deem important to my happiness. I suspect that for some of these folks, that's what they realized. They had the good life, they had everything under control, everything was smooth going forward, and suddenly out of the blue, the God of disruption comes into their life. And suddenly everything is different. Now there have been some commentators that say, well, what about the poor pigs? And what about those poor pig herders up there? And what's hard for us to see because of our fallenness is the supreme value of one individual who's going to live for eternity and who's going to have an impact on the people around him the rest of his life, on those people who are also going to live for eternity, and in the next generation, and in the next generation, and in the next generation, rather than 2,000 pigs who are finite, not made in the image of God, and not personal. If there's something that rankles you about that, then that's something to wrestle with. What is it that's really of most value to you? In the book of Job 21, the people of in the region there reminded me of this particular verse in Job. Yet they say to God, leave us alone. We have no desire to know your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? But their prosperity is not in their own hands. He's describing the illusion of control in our lives. That which we think we want control, and yet it's so elusive. What strikes me from the pigs here is God will sometimes sacrifice what is good for the sake of the best. He wants us to discover real treasure, and that is himself. And that trade-off is worth virtually everything from his point of view. It may not be from your point of view or my point of view, but this story illustrates from his point of view. Now, the story ends on a tremendous climax, and there are several turns here that you just don't see coming. Verse 18, as Jesus was getting into the boat, the idea is that he's leaving, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. And I guess so. I suspect if I had been him and had new life, I would have wanted to do that too. Verse 19, Jesus says something that's completely unexpected. Go home to your family. Go back there. And tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. Now, this is a stunning statement to me. But think of the, I think of three things that have happened to this man where Jesus can say, you've got a story to tell, go tell it. And that is, first of all, he's given new life. There's something new at the center of his heart, the center of his soul, that is now of greater power than just the self that had curved in upon itself and even whatever demon possession had driven him. New life. The second thing is that this is a man with a new identity. He was no longer man of the tombs. He would say, I have discovered the wonder of mercy. I've been forgiven. Past? Yeah, I have a past, but that really doesn't matter anymore. What matters is what's going forward. I have a clean slate. I'm a new man. Identity. A new life, a new identity, and a new purpose. And this, to me, is the most astounding. You have a story to tell. Go tell it. So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. Now, this particular story, we sort of looked at from sort of God's point of view as the story is written. But I'd like to tell the story as if I'd been there, one of the disciples. We had been ministering, it seemed like day after day, from dawn to dusk, the endless movement of people, not yet. The endless moving of people day after day, and we were exhausted, and Jesus was exhausted, and he said, get in the boat. We're going to go to the eastern side, and we were so happy to finally get away, but about halfway across, a horrible storm hit, one that none of us had ever been a part of before. The wind and waves rocked the boat such that we thought we were going to die. We thought that the boat was going to take on too much water, founder, and settle to the bottom of the sea. And we were too far away for any of us to swim. Jesus got up, and he spoke to the wind, and he spoke to the waves. And in the next few moments, the wind died down, and the waves became almost like glass, and we were terrified. What kind of man is it that can still the wind and the waves? But we were happy that we were saved, and we bailed out the rest of the water, and I'm really not sure how we ended up getting to the eastern shore. I suspect some of us rowed. The sail was gone. But finally, about the time of the earliest morning in the eastern hills, not yet dawn, but you could see the orange of light on top of the hills, and there was a fog bank that was dissipating as our little boat, our fishing boat, came up with the 13 of us. And we slid up onto the bank. And we all jumped out of the boat, still sopping wet for the night before. And hardly any of us had any sleep. And it was quiet. You could hear the lapping of the water on the sides of the boat. But then suddenly, I remember hearing a noise that I had never heard before. And it came from somewhere up in the hills. And I really wasn't sure what it was. At first I thought it was just a long moan. Kind of a groan, extended. But then it had an eerie feel to it, almost like it changed into a howl. And then there was something of rage in the voice. I couldn't make it out what kind of animal or creature it was. I'd never heard it before. We looked up into the hills and we could see that there was a cemetery up there. We could see some marked graves, a few tombs, and a cave or two. And as the fog was lifting, then suddenly we saw something we could hardly believe. There was a man, or at least it looked like a man, a creature, running down out of that hills toward us. And we could hear at first the clanking of metal. And we noticed that he had shackles around his wrists and around his ankles. And he had broken the chains, and this metal was clanging as he ran. And then as he got closer down the hills, we saw he was naked. And he was a horrendous-looking creature. He had hair down to his waist, matted, darkened, and a beard that hadn't been shaved in I don't know how long. And as he got closer, we saw he had cuts all over his body, his arms and his torso and his legs. And I remember wanting the back end of the boat, and I my buddies were kind of, we were all doing the same thing, except Jesus, he seemed to be completely unfazed by this. And suddenly as the man got closer, he ran right up to Jesus and plopped down in front of him on his knees. And he said some words that at first stirred the heart, and at other times that, oh no, this man is such a mess. But Jesus engaged in conversation with him. And the man stood up, and Jesus said a few more words to him. And suddenly, we heard this great squealing and screaming from the distant hill up the shoreline. And up on the bluff there were thousands of pigs all screaming and running into each other and just mayhem, a melee. And suddenly, they all got together and ran headlong towards the edge of the cliff. And then one, two, three, by fives and tens and twenties, off the edge of the cliff, down through the air, down into the Sea of Galilee, and splat, 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 to where finally all 2,000 were gone. At least the 12 of us just sat there mesmerized. When the last pig had gone off, we looked around, and we saw that the man was still sitting down. And Jesus had taken off his own cloak and put it around the man, and he was knelt down, and the two of them were having the most delightful conversation. It was one of the most amazing things I'd ever seen. The man wanted to go with us. And I thought that, I wasn't sure how good an idea that was for us, but it seemed like it would be a good idea for him. But Jesus said something that just stumped me. He said, "You have a story to tell. Go back to your home and tell that story to your family and friends and the people that you grew up with and in your home." And he did. Father, we've seen and marveled at your power over nature, the wind and the waves, over creation. But there's no power so great as to be able to turn our fallen nature and to make us alive to you, to value you above everything else, to love you, and then to become a people with a new life and new identities and a new purpose. No matter how desperate our background has been, no matter what depth of failure we have experienced. If you're here this morning and you've never surrendered your life, your heart, if you've never knelt before God and say, "I am a sinner through and through. I continue to turn away from you and to live for what's most important to me." Forgiveness is offered to you because of what happened on the cross. And a new life is possible for you through Jesus Christ.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.